Not so overwhelming, however, as if it had then been given to me to know that I should never return to it again. Master Ford urged me to take his place occasionally on the horse to rest me, but I said no. I was not tired, and it was better for me to walk than him. He said many kind and cheering things to me on the way, riding slowly in order that I might keep pace with him. The goodness of God was manifest, he declared in my miraculous escape from the swamp. As Daniel came forth unharmed from the den of lions, and as Jonah had been preserved in the whale's belly, even so I had been delivered from evil by the Almighty. He interrogated me in regard to the various fears and emotions I had experienced during the day and night, and if I had felt at any time a desire to pray. I felt forsaken of the whole world, I answered him, and was praying mentally all the while. At such times, said he, the heart of man turns instinctively towards his Maker. In prosperity, and when there is nothing to injure or make him afraid, he remembers him not, and is ready to defy him. But place him in the midst of dangers, cut him off from human aid, let the grave open before him, then it is in the time of his tribulation that the scoffer and unbelieving man turns to God for help, feeling there is no other hope or refuge or safety save in his protecting arm. So did that benign man speak to me of this life and of the life hereafter, of the goodness and power of God, and of the vanity of earthly things, as we journeyed along the solitary road towards Bayou Bœuf. When within some 5 miles of the plantation, we discovered a horseman at a distance, galloping towards us. As he came near, I saw that it was Tibbets. He looked at me a moment, but did not address me, and turning about, rode along side by side with Ford. I trotted silently at the horse's heels, listening to the conversation. Ford informed him of my arrival in the pine woods 3 days before, of the sad plight I was in, and of the difficulties and dangers I had encountered. "Well," exclaimed Tibbets, omitting his usual oaths in the presence of Ford, "I never saw such running before. I'll bet him against $100. He'll beat any nigger in Louisiana." I offered John David Cheney $25 to catch him, dead or alive, but he outran his dogs in a fair race. Them Cheney dogs ain't much, after all. Dunwoody's hounds would have had him down before he touched the palmettos. Somehow the dogs got off the track, and we had to give up the hunt. We rode the horses as far as we could, and then kept on foot till the water was 3 feet deep. The boys said he was drowned, sure. I allow I wanted a shot at him mightily, and ever since I've been riding up and down the bayou, but hadn't much hope of catching him. Thought he was dead, certain. Oh, he's a cuss to run, that nigger is. In this way, Tibbets ran on, describing his search in the swamp, the wonderful speed with which I had fled before the hounds, and when he had finished, Master Ford responded by saying I had always been a willing and faithful boy with him, that he was sorry we had such trouble, that according to Platt's story he had been inhumanly treated, and that he, Tibbets, was himself at fault. Using hatchets and broad axes upon slaves was shameful. It should not be allowed, he remarked. This is no way of dealing with them. When first brought into the country, it will have a pernicious influence and set them all running away. The swamps will be full of them. A little kindness would be far more effectual in restraining them and rendering them obedient than the use of such deadly weapons. Every planter on the bayou should frown upon such inhumanity. It is for the interest of all to do so. It is evident enough, Mr. Tibbets, that you and Platt cannot live together. You dislike him and would not hesitate to kill him, and knowing it, he will run from you again through fear of his life. Now, Tibbets, you must sell him or hire him out at least. Unless you do so, I shall take measures to get him out of your possession. In this spirit, Ford addressed him the remainder of the distance. I opened not my mouth. On reaching the plantation, they entered the great house, while I repaired to Eliza's cabin. The slaves were astonished to find me there, on returning from the field, supposing I was drowned. That night again, They gathered about the cabin to listen to the story of my adventure. They took it for granted I would be whipped. That would be severe, the well-known penalty of running away being 500 lashes. "Poor fellow," said Eliza, taking me by the hand. "It would have been better for you if you had drowned. You have a cruel master, and he will kill you yet, I'm afraid." Lawson suggested that it might be Overseer Chapin would be appointed to inflict the punishment, in which case it would not be severe. Whereupon Mary, Rachel, Bristol, and others hoped it would be Master Ford, and then it would be no whipping at all. They all pitied me and tried to console me, and were sad in view of the castigation that awaited me. Except Kentucky John. There were no bounds to his laughter. He filled the cabin with cachinations, holding his sides to prevent an explosion, and the cause of his noisy mirth was the idea of my outstripping the hounds. Somehow he looked at the subject in a comical light. "I knowed they wouldn't have caught him when he run across the plantation. Oh, the Lord! Didn't Platt pick his feet right up, though, eh? Ha ha! When them dogs got where he was, he wasn't there. Ha 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 ha! Oh, Lord Almighty!" And then Kentucky John relapsed into another of his boisterous fits. Early the next morning, Tibbetts left the plantation. In the course of the forenoon, while sauntering about the gin house, a tall, good-looking man came to me and inquired if I was Tibbetts' boy, that youthful appellation being applied indiscriminately to slaves even though they may have passed the number of 80 years. I took off my hat and answered that I was. "How would you like to work for me?" he inquired. "Oh, I would like to very much," I said, inspired with a sudden hope of getting away from Tibbetts. "You worked under Myers at Peter Tanner's, didn't you?" I replied I had, adding some complimentary remarks that Myers had made concerning me. "Well, boy," said he, "I have hired you of your master to work for me in the big canebrake, 38 miles from here, down on Red River." This man was Mr. Eldred, who lived below Ford's on the same side of the bayou. I accompanied him to his plantation, and in the morning started with his slave Sam and a wagon load of provisions drawn by 4 mules for the big cane, Eldred and Myers having preceded us on horseback. This Sam was a native of Charleston, where he had a mother, brother, and sisters. He allowed a common word among both black and white, that Tibbetts was a mean man, and hoped, as I most earnestly did also, that his master would buy me. We proceeded down the south shore of the bayou, crossing it at Carey's plantation, from thence to Huff Power, passing which we came upon the Bayou Rouge Road, which runs towards Red River. After passing through Bayou Rouge Swamp, and just at sunset, turning from the highway, we struck off into the Big Cane Brake. We followed an unbeaten track, scarcely wide enough to admit the wagon. The cane, such as are used for fishing rods, were as thick as they could stand. A person could not be seen through them the distance of a rod. The paths of wild beasts run through them in various directions. The bear and the American tiger abounding in these brakes, and wherever there is a basin of stagnant water, it is full of alligators. We kept on our lonely course through the Big Cane several miles, when we entered a clearing known as Sutton's Field. Many years before, a man by the name of Sutton had penetrated the wilderness of Cane to this solitary place. Tradition has it that he fled thither, a fugitive, not from service, but from justice. Here he lived alone, recluse and hermit of the swamp, with his own hands planting the seed and gathering in the harvest. One day, a band of Indians stole upon his solitude, and after a bloody battle, overpowered and massacred him. For miles, the country round, in the slaves' quarters and on the piazzas of great houses, where white children listen to superstitious tales, the story goes that that spot in the heart of the Big Cane is a haunted place. For more than a quarter of a century, human voices had rarely, if ever, disturbed the silence of the clearing. Rank and noxious weeds have overspread the once cultivated field. Serpents sunned themselves in the doorway of the crumbling cabin. It was indeed a dreary picture of desolation. Passing Sutton's Field, we followed a new cut road 2 miles farther, which brought us to its termination. We had now reached the wild lands of Mr. Eldred, where he contemplated clearing up an extensive plantation. We went to work next morning with our cane knives and cleared a sufficient space to allow the erection of two cabins, one for Myers and Eldred, the other for Sam, myself, and the slaves that were to join us. We were now in the midst of trees of enormous growth, whose wide-spreading branches almost shut out the light of the sun, while the space between the trunks was an impervious mass of cane, with here and there an occasional palmetto. The bay and the sycamore, the oak and the cypress, reached a growth unparalleled in those fertile lowlands bordering the Red River. From every tree, moreover, hang long, large masses of moss, presenting to the eye unaccustomed to them a striking and singular appearance. This moss, in large quantities, is sent north and they're used for manufacturing purposes. We cut down oaks, split them into rails, and with these erected temporary cabins. We covered the roofs with the broad palmetto leaf, an excellent substitute for shingles, as long as they last. The greatest annoyance I met with here were small flies, gnats, and mosquitoes. They swarmed the air. They penetrated the portions of the ear, the nose, the eyes, the mouth. They sucked themselves beneath the skin. It was impossible to brush or beat them off. It seemed, indeed, as if they would devour us, carry us away piecemeal in their small, tormenting mouths. A lonelier spot, or one more disagreeable than the center of the big canebrake, it would be difficult to conceive. Yet to me it was a paradise, in comparison with any other place in the company of Master Tibbets. I labored hard, and oft-times was weary and fatigued. Yet I could lie down in peace and arise in the morning without fear. In the course of a fortnight, four black girls came down from Eldred's plantation. Charlotte, Fanny, Cretia, and Nellie. They were all large and stout. Axes were put into their hands, and they were sent out with Sam and myself to cut trees. They were excellent choppers, the largest oak or sycamore standing but a brief season before the heavy and well-directed blows. At piling logs, they were equal to any man. There are lumber women as well as lumber men in the forests of the South. In fact, in the region of Bayou Bœuf, they perform their share of all the labor required on the plantation. They plow, drag, drive team, clear wild lands, work on the highway, and so forth. Some planters owning large cotton and sugar plantations have none other than the labor of slave women. Such a one is Jim Burns, who lives on the north shore of the bayou, opposite the plantation of John Fogelman. On our arrival in the break, Eldred promised me if I worked well, I might go up to visit my friends at Ford's in 4 weeks. On Saturday night of the fifth week, I reminded him of his promise. When he told me I had done so well that I might go, I had set my heart upon it, and Eldred's announcement filled me with pleasure. I was to return in time to commence the labors of the day on Tuesday morning. While indulging in the pleasant anticipation of so soon meeting my old friends again, suddenly the hateful form of Tibbets appeared among us. He inquired how Myers and Platt got along together, and was told very well, and that Platt was going up to Ford's plantation in the morning on a visit. "Paw, paw," sneered Tibbets. "It isn't worthwhile. The nigger will get unsteady. He can't go." But Eldred insisted I had worked faithfully, that he had given me his promise, and that under the circumstances I ought not to be disappointed. They then, it being about dark, entered one cabin and I the other. I could not give up the idea of going. It was a sore disappointment. Before morning I resolved, if Eldred made no objection, to leave at all hazards. At daylight I was at his door with my blanket rolled up into a bundle, and hanging on a stick over my shoulder, waiting for a pass. Tibbets came out presently in one of his disagreeable moods, washed his face, and going to a stump nearby, sat down upon it, apparently busily thinking with himself. After standing there a long time, impelled by a sudden impulse of impatience, I started off. "Are you going without a pass?" he cried out to me. "Yes, master. I thought I would," I answered. "How do you think you get there?" demanded he. "Don't know," was all the reply I made him. "You'd be taking us into jail where you ought to be before you got halfway there," he added, passing into the cabin as he said it. He came out soon with the pass in his hand and calling me "damn nigger that deserved 100 lashes." Threw it on the ground, I picked it up and hurried away right speedily. A slave caught off his master's plantation without a pass may be seized and whipped by any white man whom he meets. The one I now received was dated and read as follows. "Platt has permission to go to Ford's plantation on Bayou Beef and return by Tuesday morning. John M. Tibbetts." This is the usual form. On the way, a great many demanded it, read it, and passed on. Those having the air and appearance of gentlemen, whose dress indicated the possession of wealth, frequently took no notice of me whatever. But a shabby fellow, an unmistakable loafer, never failed to hail me and to scrutinize and examine me in the most thorough manner. Catching runaways is sometimes a money-making business. If after advertising no owner appears, they may be sold to the highest bidder, and certain fees are allowed the finder for his services. At all events, even if reclaimed, a mean white, therefore a name applied to the species loafer, considers it a godsend to meet an unknown Negro without a pass. There are no inns along the highways in that portion of the state where I sojourned. I was wholly destitute of money. Neither did I carry any provisions on my journey from the Big Cane to Bayou Beef. Nevertheless, with his pass in his hand, a slave need never suffer from hunger or from thirst. It is only necessary to present it to the master or overseer of a plantation and state his wants, when he will be sent round to the kitchen and provided with food or shelter, as the case may require. The traveller stops at any house and calls for a meal with as much freedom as if it was a public tavern. It is the general custom of the country. Whatever their faults may be, it is certain the inhabitants along Red River and around the bayous in the interior of Louisiana are not wanting in hospitality. I arrived at Ford's plantation towards the close of the afternoon, passing the evening in Eliza's cabin with Lawson, Rachel, and others of my acquaintance. When we left Washington, Eliza's form was round and plump. She stood erect, and in her silks and jewels presented a picture of graceful strength and elegance. Now she was but a thin shadow of her former self. Her face had become ghastly haggard, and the once straight and active form was bowed down, as if bearing the weight of 100 years. Crouching on her cabin floor and clad in the coarse garments of a slave, old Elisha Berry would not have recognized the mother of his child. I never saw her afterwards. Having become useless in the cotton field, she was bartered for a trifle to some man residing in the vicinity of Peter Compton's. Grief had gnawed remorselessly at her heart until the strength was gone, and for that her last master, it is said, lashed and abused her most unmercifully. But he could not whip back the departed vigor of her youth, nor straighten up that bended body to its full height, such as it was when her children were around her and the light of freedom was shining on her path. I learned the particulars relative to her departure from this world from some of Compton's slaves, who had come over Red River to the bayou to assist young Madam Tanner during the busy season. She became at length, they said, utterly helpless, for several weeks lying on the ground floor in a dilapidated cabin, dependent upon the mercy of her fellow thralls for an occasional drop of water and a morsel of food. Her master did not knock her on the head, as is sometimes done to put a suffering animal out of misery, but left her unprovided for and unprotected to linger through a life of pain and wretchedness to its natural close. When the hands returned from the field one night, they found her dead. During the day, the angel of the Lord, who moveth invisibly over all the earth, gathering in his harvests of departing souls, had silently entered the cabin of the dying woman and taken her from thence. She was free at last. Next day, rolling up my blanket, I started on my return to the Big Cane. After traveling 5 miles at a place called Huffpower, the ever-present Tibbets met me in the road. He inquired why I was going back so soon, and when informed I was anxious to return by the time I was directed, he said I need to go no farther than the next plantation, as he had that day sold me to Edwin Epps. We walked down into the yard, where we met the latter gentleman, who examined me and asked me the usual questions propounded by purchasers. Having been duly delivered over, I was ordered to the quarters, and at the same time directed to make a hoe and axe handle for myself. I was now no longer the property of Tibbets, his dog, his brute, dreading his wrath and cruelty day and night, and whoever or whatever my new master might prove to be, I could not certainly regret the change. So it was good news when the sale was announced, and with a sigh of relief, I sat down for the first time in my new abode. Tibbets soon after disappeared from that section of the country. Once afterwards, and only once, I caught a glimpse of him. He was many miles from Bayou Beth. He was seated in the doorway of a low groggery. I was passing in a drove of slaves through St. Mary's Parish. Chapter 12. Edwin Epps, of whom much will be said during the remainder of this history, is a large, portly, heavy-bodied man, with light hair, high cheekbones, and a Roman nose of extraordinary dimensions. He has blue eyes, a fair complexion, and is, as I should say, full 6 feet high. He has the sharp, inquisitive expression of a jockey. His manners are repulsive and coarse, and his language gives speedy and unequivocal evidence that he has never enjoyed the advantages of an education. He has the faculty of saying most provoking things in that respect, even excelling old Peter Tanner. At the time I came into his possession, Edwin Epps was fond of the bottle, his sprees sometimes extending over the space of 2 whole weeks. Latterly, however, he had reformed his habits, and when I left him, was as strict a specimen of temperance as could be found on Bayou Beff. When in his cups, Master Epps was a roistering, blustering, noisy fellow, whose chief delight was in dancing with his niggers or lashing them about the yard with his long whip, just for the pleasure of hearing them screech and scream, as the great welts were planted on their backs. When sober, he was silent, reserved and cunning, not beating us indiscriminately, as in his drunken moments, but sending the end of his rawhide to some tender spot of a lagging slave, with a sly dexterity peculiar to himself. He had been a driver and overseer in his younger years, but at this time was in possession of a plantation on Bayou Huffpower, 2.5 miles from Holmesville, 18 from Marksville, and 12 from Cheneyville. It belonged to Joseph B. Roberts, his wife's uncle, and was leased by Epps. His principal business was raising cotton, and inasmuch as some may read this book who have never seen a cotton field, a description of the manner of its culture may not be out of place. The ground is prepared by throwing up beds or ridges with the plow, back furrowing, it's called. Oxen and mules, the latter almost exclusively, are used in plowing. The women, as frequently as the men, perform this labor, feeding, currying, and taking care of their teams, and in all respects doing the field and stable work precisely as do the plowboys of the north. The beds or ridges are 6 feet wide, that is, from water furrow to water furrow. A plow drawn by one mule is then run along the top of the ridge or center of the bed, making the drill into which a girl usually drops the seed, which she carries in a bag hung around her neck. Behind her comes a mule and harrow, covering up the seed, so that 2 mules, 3 slaves, a plow and harrow are employed in planting a row of cotton. This is done in the months of March and April. Corn is planted in February. When there are no cold rains, the cotton usually makes its appearance in a week. In the course of 8 or 10 days afterwards, the first hoeing is commenced. This is performed in part also by the aid of the plow and mule. The plow passes as near as possible to the cotton on both sides, throwing the furrow from it. Slaves follow with their hoes, cutting up the grass and cotton, leaving hills 2 feet and a half apart. This is called scraping cotton. In 2 weeks more commences the second hoeing. This time the furrow is thrown towards the cotton. Only one stalk, the largest, is now left standing in each hill. In another fortnight, it is hoed the third time, throwing the furrow towards the cotton in the same manner as before, and killing all the grass between the rows. About the 1st of July, when it is a foot high or thereabouts, it is hoed the fourth and last time. Now the whole space between the rows is plowed, leaving a deep water furrow in the center. During all these hoeings, the overseer or driver follows the slaves on horseback with a whip, such as been described. The fastest hoer takes the lead row. He is usually about a rod in advance of his companions. If one of them passes him, he is whipped. If one falls behind or is a moment idle, he is whipped. In fact, the lash is flying from morning until night, the whole day long. The hoeing season thus continues from April until July, a field having no sooner been finished once than it is commenced again. In the latter part of August begins the cotton-picking season. At this time, each slave is presented with a sack. A strap is fastened to it, which goes over the neck, holding the mouth of the sack breast high, while the bottom reaches nearly to the ground. Each one is also presented with a large basket that will hold about 2 barrels. This is to put the cotton in when the sack is filled. The baskets are carried to the field and placed at the beginning of the rows. When a new hand, one unaccustomed to the business, is sent for the first time into the field, he is whipped up smartly and made for that day to pick as fast as he can possibly. At night, it is weighed, so that his capability in cotton picking is known. He must bring in the same weight each night following. If it falls short, it is considered evidence that he has been laggard, and a greater or less number of lashes is the penalty. An ordinary day's work is 200 pounds. A slave who is accustomed to picking is punished if he or she brings in a less quantity than that. There is a great difference among them as regards this kind of labor. Some of them seem to have a natural knack or quickness which enables them to pick with great celerity and with both hands, while others, with whatever practice or industry, are utterly unable to come up to the ordinary standard. Such hands are taken from the cotton field and employed in other business. Patsy, of whom I shall have more to say, was known as the most remarkable cotton picker in Bayou Bœuf. She picked with both hands and with such surprising rapidity that 500 pounds a day was not unusual for her. Each one is tasked, therefore, according to his picking abilities, none, however, to come short of 200 weight. I, being unskillful always in that business, would have satisfied my master by bringing in the latter quantity, while, on the other hand, Patsy would surely have been beaten if she failed to produce twice as much. The cotton grows from 5 to 7 feet high, each stalk having a great many branches, shooting out in all directions and lapping each other above the water furrow. There are few sights more pleasant to the eye than a wide cotton field when it is in bloom. It presents an appearance of purity, like an immaculate expanse of light, new-fallen snow. Sometimes the slave picks down one side of a row and back upon the other, but more usually there is one on either side gathering all that has blossomed, leaving the unopened bowls for a succeeding picking. When the sack is filled, it is emptied into the basket and trodden down. It is necessary to be extremely careful the first time going through the field in order not to break the branches off the stalks. The cotton will not bloom upon a broken branch. Epps never failed to inflict the severest chastisement on the unlucky servant who either carelessly or unavoidably was guilty in the least degree in this respect. The hands are required to be in the cotton field as soon as it is light in the morning, and with the exception of 10 or 15 minutes which is given them at noon to swallow their allowance of cold bacon, they are not permitted to be a moment idle until it is too dark to see, and when the moon is full, they oftentimes labor till the middle of the night. They do not dare to stop even at dinner time, nor return to the quarters, however late it be, until the order to halt is given by the driver. The day's work over in the field, the baskets are toted, or in other words, carried to the gin house where the cotton is weighed. No matter how fatigued and weary he may be, no matter how much he longs for sleep and rest, a slave never approaches the gin house with his basket of cotton, but with fear. If it falls short in weight, if he has not performed the full task appointed him, he knows that he must suffer. If he has exceeded it by 10 or 20 pounds, in all probability, his master will measure the next day's task accordingly. So whether he has too little or too much, his approach to the gin house is always with fear and trembling. Most frequently, they have too little, and therefore it is they are not anxious to leave the field. After weighing, follow the whippings, and then the baskets are carried to the cotton house, and their contents stored away like hay, all hands being sent in to tramp it down. If the cotton is not dry, instead of taking it to the gin house at once, it is laid upon platforms 2 feet high, and some 3 times as wide, covered with boards of plank, with narrow walks running between them. This done, the labor of the day is not yet ended, by any means. Each one must then attend to his respective chores. One feeds the mules, another the swine, another cuts the wood, and so forth. Besides, the packing is all done by candlelight. Finally, at a late hour, they reach the quarters, sleepy and overcome with the long day's toil. Then a fire must be kindled in the cabin, the corn ground in the small handmill, and supper and dinner for the next day in the field prepared. All that is allowed them is corn and bacon, which is given out at the corn crib at Smokehouse every Sunday morning. Each one receives, as his weekly allowance, 3.5 pounds of bacon and corn, enough to make a peck of meal. That is all. No tea, coffee, sugar, and with the exception of a very scanty sprinkling now and then, no salt. I can say, from a 10 years' residence with Master Epps, that no slave of his is ever likely to suffer from the gout, superinduced by excessive high living. Master Epps' hogs were fed on shelled corn. It was thrown out to his niggers in the ear. The former, he thought, would fatten faster by shelling and soaking it in the water. The latter, perhaps, if treated in the same manner, might grow too fat to labor. Master Epps was a shrewd calculator and knew how to manage his own animals, drunk or sober. The corn mill stands in the yard beneath a shelter. It is like a common coffee mill, the hopper holding about 6 quarts. There was one privilege which Master Epps granted freely to every slave he had. They might grind their corn nightly in such small quantities as their daily wants required, or they might grind the whole week's allowance at one time on Sundays, just as they preferred. A very generous man was Master Epps. I kept my corn in a small wooden box, the meal in a gourd, and by the way, the gourd is one of the most convenient and necessary utensils on a plantation. Besides supplying the place of all kinds of crockery in a slave cabin, it is used for carrying water to the fields. Another also contains the dinner. It dispenses with the necessity of pails, dippers, basins, and sets tin and wooden superfluities all together. When the corn is ground and fire is made, the bacon is taken down from the nail on which it hangs, a slice cut off and thrown upon the coals to broil. The majority of slaves have no knife, much less a fork. They cut their bacon with the axe at the woodpile. The cornmeal is mixed with a little water, placed in the fire, and baked. When it is done brown, the ashes are scraped off, and being placed upon a chip, which answers for a table, the tenant of the slave hut is ready to sit down upon the ground to supper. By this time, it is usually midnight. The same fear of punishment with which they approach the gin house possesses them again on lying down to get a snatch of rest. It is the fear of oversleeping in the morning. Such an offense would certainly be attended with not less than 20 lashes. With a prayer that he may be on his feet and wide awake at the first sound of the horn, he sinks to his slumbers nightly. The softest couches in the world are not to be found in the log mansion of the slave. The one whereon I reclined year after year was a plank 12 inches wide and 10 feet long. My pillow was a stick of wood. The bedding was a coarse blanket, and not a rag or shred beside. Moss might be used, were it not that it directly breeds the swarm of fleas. The cabin is constructed of logs, without floor or window. The latter is altogether unnecessary, the crevices between the logs emitting sufficient light. In stormy weather, the rain drives through them, rendering it comfortless and extremely disagreeable. The rude door hangs on great wooden hinges. In one end is constructed an awkward fireplace. An hour before daylight, the horn is blown. Then the slaves arouse, prepare their breakfast, fill a gourd with water, in another deposit their dinner of cold bacon and corn cake, and hurry to the field again. It is an offense invariably followed by a flogging to be found at the quarters after daybreak. Then the fears and labors of another day begin. And until its close, there's no such thing as rest. He fears he will be caught lagging through the day. He fears to approach the gin house with his basket load of cotton at night. He fears when he lies down that he will oversleep himself in the morning. Such is a true, faithful, unexaggerated picture and description of the slave's daily life during the time of cotton picking on the shores of Bayou Bœuf. In the month of January, generally, the fourth and last picking is completed. Then commences the harvesting of corn. This is considered a secondary crop and receives far less attention than the cotton. It is planted, as already mentioned, in February. Corn is grown in that region for the purpose of fattening hogs and feeding slaves, very little, if any, being sent to market. It is the white variety, the ear of great size, and a stalk growing to the height of 8 and oftentimes 10 feet. In August, the leaves are stripped off, dried in the sun, bound in small bundles, and stored away as provender for the mules and oxen. After this, the slaves go through the field, turning down the ear for the purpose of keeping the rains from penetrating to the grain. It is left in this condition until after cotton picking is over, whether earlier or later. Then the ears are separated from the stalks and deposited in the corn crib with the husks on. Otherwise, stripped of the husks, the weevil would destroy it. The stalks are left standing in the field. The Carolina or sweet potato is also grown in that region to some extent. They are not fed, however, to hogs or cattle, and are considered but of small importance. They are preserved by placing them upon the surface of the ground, with a slight covering of earth or corn stalks. There is not a cellar on Bayou Bœuf. The ground is so low it would fill with water. Potatoes are worth from 2 to 3 bits, or shillings, a barrel. Corn, except when there is an unusual scarcity, can be purchased at the same rate. As soon as the cotton and corn crops are secured, the stalks are pulled up, thrown into piles, and burned. The plows are started at the same time, throwing up the beds again, preparatory to another planting. The soil in the parishes of Rapides and of Oils, and throughout the whole country, so far as my observation extended, is of exceeding richness and fertility. It is a kind of marl of a brown or reddish color. It does not require those invigorating composts necessary to more barren lands, and on the same field the same crop is grown for many successive years. Plowing, planting, picking cotton, gathering the corn, and pulling and burning stalks occupies the whole of the four seasons of the year. Drawing and cutting wood, pressing cotton, fattening and killing hogs are but incidental labors. In the month of September or October, the hogs are run out of the swamps by dogs and confined in pens. On a cold morning, generally about New Year's Day, they are slaughtered. Each carcass is cut into 6 parts and piled one above the other in salt upon large tables in the smokehouse. In this condition, it remains a fortnight, when it is hung up and the fire built, and continued more than half the time during the remainder of the year. This thorough smoking is necessary to prevent the bacon from becoming infested with worms. In so warm a climate, it is difficult to preserve it, and very many times myself and my companions have received our weekly allowance of 3.5 pounds when it was full of these disgusting vermin. Although the swamps are overrun with cattle, they are never made the source of profit to any considerable extent. The planter cuts his mark upon the ear or brands his initials upon the side and turns them into the swamps, to roam unrestricted within their almost limitless confines. They are the Spanish breed, small and spike-horned. I have known of droves being taken from Bayou Bœuf, but it is a very rare occurrence. The value of the best cows is about $5 each. 2 quarts at one milking would be considered an unusual large quantity. They furnish little tallow and that of a soft, inferior quality. Notwithstanding, the great number of cows that throng the swamps. The planters are indebted to the North for their cheese and butter, which is purchased in the New Orleans market. Salted beef is not an article of food, either in the great house or in the cabin. Master Epps was accustomed to attend shooting matches for the purpose of obtaining what fresh beef he required. These sports occurred weekly at the neighboring village of Holmesville. Fat beeves are driven thither and shot at, a stipulated price being demanded for the privilege. The lucky marksman divides the flesh among his fellows, and in this manner the attending planters are supplied. The great number of tame and untamed cattle which swarm the woods and swamps of Bayou Bœuf most probably suggested that appellation to the French, inasmuch as the term translated signifies the creek or river of the wild ox. Garden products such as cabbages, turnips, and the like are cultivated for the use of the master and his family. They have greens and vegetables at all times and seasons of the year. The grass withereth and the flower fadeth before the desolating winds of autumn and the chill northern latitudes. But perpetual verdure overspreads the hot lowlands, and flowers bloom in the heart of winter in the region of Bayou Bœuf. There are no meadows appropriated to the cultivation of the grasses. The leaves of the corn supply a sufficiency of food for the laboring cattle, while the rest provide for themselves all the year in the ever-growing pasture. There are many other peculiarities of climate, habit, custom, and of the manner of living and laboring at the South, but the foregoing, it is supposed, will give the reader an insight and general idea of life on a cotton plantation in Louisiana. The mode of cultivating cane and the process of sugar manufacturing will be mentioned in another place. Chapter 13. On my arrival at Master Epps, in obedience to his order, the first business upon which I entered was the making of an axe helve. The handles in use there are simply a round, straight stick. I made a crooked one, shaped like those to which I had been accustomed in the North. When finished and presented to Epps, he looked at it with astonishment, unable to determine exactly what it was. He had never before seen such a handle, and when I explained its conveniences, he was forcibly struck with the novelty of the idea. He kept it in the house a long time, and when his friends called, was wont to exhibit it as a curiosity. It was now the season of hoeing. I was first sent into the cornfield, and afterwards set to scraping cotton. In this employment I remained until hoeing time was nearly past, when I began to experience the symptoms of approaching illness. I was attacked with chills, which were succeeded by a burning fever. I became weak and emaciated, and frequently so dizzy it caused me to reel and stagger like a drunken man. Nevertheless, I was compelled to keep up my row. When in health, I found little difficulty in keeping pace with my fellow laborers. But now, it seemed to be an utter impossibility. Often I fell behind, when the driver's lash was sure to greet my back, infusing into my sick and drooping body a little temporary energy. I continued to decline until at length the whip became entirely ineffectual. The sharpest sting of the rawhide could not arouse me. Finally, in September, when the busy season of cotton picking was at hand, I was unable to leave my cabin. Up to this time I had received no medicine, nor any attention from my master or mistress. The old cook visited me occasionally, preparing me corn coffee, and sometimes boiling a bit of bacon when I had grown too feeble to accomplish it myself. When it was said that I would die, Master Epps, unwilling to bear the loss which the death of an animal worth $1,000 would bring upon him, concluded to incur the expense of sending to Holmesville for Dr. Wines. He announced to Epps that it was the effect of the climate and there was a probability of his losing me. He directed me to eat no meat and to partake of no more food than was absolutely necessary to sustain life. Several weeks elapsed, during which time, under the scanty diet to which I was subjected, I had partially recovered. One morning, long before I was in a proper condition to labor, Epps appeared at the cabin door, and presenting me a sack, ordered me to the cotton field. At this time, I had had no experience whatever in cotton picking. It was an awkward business indeed. While others used both hands, snatching the cotton and depositing it in the mouth of the sack with a precision and dexterity that was incomprehensible to me. I had to seize the bowl with one hand and deliberately draw out the white gushing blossom with the other. Depositing the cotton in the sack, moreover, was a difficulty that demanded the exercise of both hands and eyes. I was compelled to pick it from the ground where it would fall, nearly as often as from the stalk where it had grown. I made havoc also with the branches, loaded with the yet unbroken bowls. The long, cumbersome sack swinging from side to side in a manner not allowable in a cotton field. After a most laborious day, I arrived in the gin house with my load. When the scale determined its weight to be only 95 pounds, not half the quantity required of the poorest picker, Epps threatened the severest flogging, but in consideration of my being a raw hand, concluded to pardon me on that occasion. The following day, and many days succeeding, I returned at night with no better success. I was evidently not designed for that kind of labor. I have not the gift, the dexterous fingers and quick motion of Patsy, who could fly along one side of a row of cotton, stripping it of its undefiled and fleecing whiteness miraculously fast. Practice and whipping were alike unavailing, and Epps, satisfied of it at last, swore I was a disgrace, that I was not fit to associate with a cotton-picking nigger, that I could not pick enough in a day to pay the trouble of weighing it, that I should go into the cotton field no more. I was now employed in cutting and hauling wood, drawing cotton from the field to the gin house, and performed whatever other services was required. Suffice to say, I was never permitted to be idle. It was really that a day passed by without one or more whippings. This occurred at the time the cotton was weighed. The delinquent, whose weight had fallen short, was taken out, stripped, made to lie upon the ground, face downwards, when he received a punishment proportioned to his offense. It is the literal unvarnished truth that the crack of the lash and the shrieking of the slave can be heard from dark till bedtime on Epps' plantation, any day almost during the entire period of the cotton-picking season. The number of lashes is graduated according to the nature of the case. 25 are deemed a mere brush inflicted, for instance, when a dry leaf or piece of bowl is found in the cotton, or when a branch is broken in the field. 50 is the ordinary penalty following all delinquencies of the next higher grade. 100 is called severe. It is the punishment inflicted for the serious offense of standing idle in the field. From 150 to 200 is bestowed upon him who quarrels with his cabin mates. And 500, well laid on, besides the mangling of the dogs, perhaps, is certain to consign the poor, unpitied runaway to weeks of pain and agony. During the 2 years Epps remained on the plantation at Bayou Huffpower, he was in the habit, as often as once in a fortnight at least, of coming home intoxicated from Holmesville. The shooting matches almost invariably concluded with a debauch. At such times he was boisterous and half-crazy. Often he would break the dishes, chairs, and whatever furniture he could lay his hands on. When satisfied with his amusement in the house, he would seize the whip and walk forth into the yard. Then it behooved the slaves to be watchful and exceeding wary. The first one who came within reach felt the smart of his lash. Sometimes for hours he would keep them running in all directions, dodging around the corners of the cabins. Occasionally he would come upon one unawares, and if he succeeded in inflicting a fair round blow, it was a feat that much delighted him. The younger children and the agent, who had become inactive, suffered then. In the midst of the confusion, he would slyly take his stand behind the cabin, waiting with raised whip to dash it into the first black face that peeped cautiously around the corner. At other times, he would come home in a less brutal humor. Then there must be a merrymaking. Then all must move to the measure of a tune. Then Master Epps must needs regale his melodious ear with the music of a fiddle. Then did he become buoyant, elastic, gaily tripping the light fantastic toe around the piazza and all through the house. Tibbets, at the time of my sale, had informed him I could play the violin. He had received this information from Ford, through the importunities of Mistress Epps. Her husband had been induced to purchase me one during a visit to New Orleans. Frequently I was called into the house to play before the family, mistress being passionately fond of music. All of us would be assembled in the large room of the great house whenever Epps came home in one of his dancing moods. No matter how worn out and tired we were, there must be a general dance. When properly stationed on the floor, I would strike up a tune. "Dance, you damn niggers, dance," Epps would shout. Then there must be no halting or delay, no slow or languid movements. All must be brisk and lively and alert. "Up and down, heel and toe, and away we go," was the order of the hour. Epps' portly form mingled with those of his dusky slaves, moving rapidly through all the mazes of the dance. Usually his whip was in his hand, ready to fall about the ears of the presumptuous thrall who dared to rest a moment or even stop to catch his breath. When he was himself exhausted, there would be a brief cessation, but it would be very brief. With a slash and crack and flourish of the whip, he would shout again, "Dance, niggers, dance!" And away they would go once more, pell-mell, while I, spurred by an occasional sharp touch of the lash, sat in the corner, extracting from my violin a marvelous quick-stepping tune. The mistress often upbraided him, declaring she would return to her father's house at Cheneyville. Nevertheless, there were times she could not restrain a burst of laughter on witnessing his uproarious pranks. Frequently, we were thus detained until almost morning, bent with excessive toil, actually suffering for a little refreshing rest, and feeling rather as if we could cast ourselves upon the earth and weep. Many a night in the house of Edward Epps have his unhappy slaves been made to dance and laugh. Notwithstanding these deprivations in order to gratify the whim of an unreasonable master, we had to be in the field as soon as it was light, and during the day perform the ordinary and accustomed task. Such deprivations could not be urged at the scales, in extenuation of any lack of weight, or in the cornfield for not hoeing with the usual rapidity. The whippings were just as severe as if we had gone forth in the morning, strengthened and invigorated by a night's repose. Indeed, after such frantic revels, he was always more sour and savage than before, punishing for slighter causes and using the whip with increased and more vindictive energy. 10 years I toiled for that man without reward. 10 years of my incessant labor has contributed to increase the bulk of his possessions. 10 years I was compelled to address him with downcast eyes and uncovered head, in the attitude and language of a slave. I am indebted to him for nothing save undeserved abuse and stripes. Beyond the reach of his inhuman thong, and standing on the soil of the free state where I was born, thanks be to heaven, I can raise my head once more among men. I can speak of the wrongs I have suffered, and of those who inflicted them with upraised eyes. But I have no desire to speak of him or any other one otherwise than truthfully. Yet to speak truthfully of Edwin Epps would be to say, he is a man in whose heart the quality of kindness or of justice is not found. A rough, rude energy, united with an uncultivated mind and an avaricious spirit, are his prominent characteristics. He is known as a nigger breaker, distinguished for his faculty of subduing the spirit of the slave and priding himself upon his reputation in this respect, as a jockey boasts of his skill in managing a refractory horse. He looked upon a colored man not as a human being responsible to his creator for the small talent entrusted to him, but as a chattel personnel, as mere life property, no better, except in value, than his mule or dog. When the evidence, clear and indisputable, was laid before him that I was a free man, and as much entitled to my liberty as he, when on the day I left he was informed that I had a wife and children, as dear to me as his own babes to him, he only raved and swore, denouncing the law that tore me from him, and declaring he would find out the man who forwarded the letter that disclosed the place of my captivity, if there was any virtue or power in money, and would take his life. He thought of nothing but his loss, and cursed me for having been born free. He could have stood unmoved and seen the tongues of his poor slaves torn off by the roots. He could have seen them burned to ashes over a slow fire, or gnawed to death by dogs, if it only brought him profit. Such a hard, cruel, unjust man is Edwin Epps. There was but one greater savage on Bayou Bœuf than he. Jim Burns' plantation was cultivated, as already mentioned, exclusively by women. That barbarian kept their backs so sore and raw that they could not perform the customary labor demanded daily of the slave. He boasted of his cruelty, and through all the country round was accounted a more thoroughgoing, energetic man than even Epps. A brute himself, Jim Burns had not a particle of mercy for his subject brutes, and like a fool, whipped and scourged away the very strength upon which depended his amount of gain. Epps remained on Huff Power 2 years, when, having accumulated a considerable sum of money, he expended it in the purchase of the plantation on the east bank of Bayou Bœuf, where he still continues to reside. He took possession of it in 1845, after the holidays were passed. He carried thither with him 9 slaves, all of whom, except myself and Susan, who has since died, remain there yet. He made no addition to this force, and for 8 years the following were my companions in his quarter, viz. Abram, Wiley, Phoebe, Bob, Henry, Edward, and Patsy. All these, except Edward, born since, were purchased out of a drove by Epps during the time he was overseer for Archie B. Williams, whose plantation is situated on the shore of Red River, not far from Alexandria. Abram was tall, standing a full head above any common man. He is 60 years of age and was born in Tennessee. 20 years ago, he was purchased by a trader, carried into South Carolina, and sold to James Buford of Williamsburg County, in that state. In his youth, he was renowned for his great strength, but age and unremitting toil have somewhat shattered his powerful frame and enfeebled his mental faculties. Wiley is 48. He was born on the estate of William Tassel, and for many years took charge of that gentleman's ferry over the Big Black River in South Carolina. Phoebe was a slave of Buford, Tassel's neighbor, and having married Wiley, he bought the latter at her instigation. Buford was a kind master, sheriff of the county, and in those days a man of wealth. Bob and Henry are Phoebe's children by a former husband, their father having been abandoned to give place to Wiley. That seductive youth had insinuated himself into Phoebe's affections, and therefore the faithless spouse had gently kicked her first husband out of her cabin door. Edward had been born to them on Bayou Huff Power. Patsy is 23, also from Buford's plantation. She is in no wise connected with the others, but glories in the fact that she is the offspring of a Guinea nigger brought over to Cuba in a slave ship, and in the course of trade transferred to Buford, who was her mother's owner. This, as I learned from them, is a genealogical account of my master's slaves. For years they had been together. Often they recalled the memories of other days, and sighed to retrace their steps to the old home in Carolina. Troubles came upon their master Buford, which brought far greater troubles upon them. He became involved in debt, and unable to bear up against his failing fortunes, was compelled to sell these and others of his slaves. In a chain gang, they had been driven from beyond the Mississippi to the plantation of Archie B. Williams. Edwin Epps, who for a long while had been his driver and overseer, was about establishing himself in business on his own account at the time of their arrival, and accepted them in payment of his wages. Old Abram was a kind-hearted being, a sort of patriarch among us, fond of entertaining his younger brethren with grave and serious discourse. He was deeply versed in such philosophy as is taught in the cabin of the slave. But the great absorbing hobby of Uncle Abram was General Jackson, whom his younger master in Tennessee had followed to the wars. He loved to wander back in imagination to the place where he was born, and to recount the scenes of his youth during those stirring times when the nation was in arms. He had been athletic and more keen and powerful than the generality of his race, but now his eye had become dim and his natural force abated. Very often indeed, while discussing the best method of baking the whole cake, or expatiating at large upon the glory of Jackson, he would forget where he left his hat, or his hoe, or his basket, and then would the old man be laughed at if Epps was absent, and whipped if he was present. So was he perplexed continually, and sighed to think that he was growing aged and going to decay. Philosophy and Jackson and forgetfulness had played the mischief with him, and it was evident that all of them combined were fast bringing down the gray hairs of Uncle Abram to the grave. Aunt Phoebe had been an excellent field hand, but latterly was put into the kitchen, where she remained, except occasionally, in a time of uncommon hurry. She was a sly old creature, and when not in the presence of her mistress or her master, was garrulous in the extreme. Wiley, on the contrary, was silent. He performed his task without murmur or complaint, seldom indulging in the luxury of speech, except to utter a wish that he was away from Epps, back once more in South Carolina. Bob and Henry had reached the ages of 20 and 23, and were distinguished for nothing extraordinary or unusual, while Edward, a lad of 13, not able to maintain his row in the corn or the cotton field, was kept in the great house to wait on the little Eppses. Patsy was slim and straight. She stood erect as the human form is capable of standing. There was an air of loftiness in her movement that neither labor nor weariness nor punishment could destroy. Truly, Patsy was a splendid animal, and were it not that bondage had enshrouded her intellect in utter and everlasting darkness, would have been chief among 10,000 of her people. She could leap the highest fences, and the fleet hound it was indeed that could outstrip her in a race. No horse could fling her from his back. She was a skillful teamster. She turned as true a furrow as the best, and at splitting rails there were none that could excel her. When the order to halt was heard at night, she would have her mules at the crib, unharnessed, fed, and curried, before Uncle Abram had found his hat. Not, however, for all or any of these, was she chiefly famous. Such lightning-like motion was in her fingers as no other fingers ever possessed, and therefore it was that in cotton-picking time, Patsy was queen of the field. She had a genial and pleasant temper, and was faithful and obedient. Naturally, she was a joyous creature, a laughing, light-hearted girl, rejoicing in the mere sense of existence. Yet Patsy wept oftener and suffered more than any of her companions. She had been literally excoriated. Her back bore the scars of 1,000 stripes, not because she was backward in her work, nor because she was an unmindful and rebellious spirit, but because it had fallen to her lot to be the slave of a licentious master and a jealous mistress. She shrank before the lustful eye of the one, and was in danger even of her life at the hands of the other. And between the two, she was indeed accursed. In the great house, for days together, there were high and angry words, poutings and estrangement, whereof she was the innocent cause. Nothing delighted the mistress so much as to see her suffer, and more than once, when Epps had refused to sell her, as she tempted me with bribes to put her secretly to death, and bury her body in some lonely place in the margin of the swamp. Gladly would Patsy have appeased this unforgiving spirit, if it had been in her power. But not like Joseph, dared she escape from Master Epps, leaving her garment in his hand. Patsy walked under a cloud. If she uttered a word in opposition to her master's will, the lash was resorted to at once, to bring her to subjection. If she was not watchful when about her cabin, or when walking in the yard, a billet of wood or a broken bottle, perhaps, hurled from her mistress's hand, would smite her unexpectedly in the face. The enslaved victim of lust and hate, Patsy had no comfort of her life. These were my companions and fellow slaves, with whom I was accustomed to be driven to the field, and with whom it had been my lot to dwell for 10 years in the log cabins of Edwin Epps. They, if living, are yet toiling on the banks of Bayou Bef, never destined to breathe, as I now do, the blessed air of liberty, nor to shake off the heavy shackles that enthrall them, until they shall lie down forever in the dust. Chapter 14. The first year of Epps' residence on the bayou, 1845. The caterpillars almost totally destroyed the cotton crop throughout that region. There was little to be done, so that the slaves were necessarily idle half the time. However, there came a rumor to Bayou Bef that wages were high and laborers in great demand on the sugar plantations in St. Mary's Parish. This parish is situated on the coast of the Gulf of Mexico, about 140 miles from Avoyelles. The Rio Teche, a considerable stream, flows through St. Mary's to the Gulf. It was determined by the planters, on the receipt of this intelligence, to make up a drove of slaves to be sent down to Tuckapaw in St. Mary's for the purpose of hiring them out in the cane field. Accordingly, in the month of September, there were 147 collected at Holmesville. Abram, Bob, and myself among the number. Of these, about one half were women. Epps, Alonso, Pierce, Henry Toller, and Addison Roberts were the white men selected to accompany and take charge of the drove. They had a two-horse carriage and two saddle horses for the use, a large wagon drawn by four horses and driven by John, a boy belonging to Mr. Roberts, carried the blankets and provisions. About 2 o'clock in the afternoon, having been fed, preparations were made to depart. The duty assigned to me was to take charge of the blankets and provisions and see that none were lost by the way. The carriage proceeded in advance, the wagon following. Behind this the sleighs were arranged, while the two horsemen brought up the rear, and in this order the procession moved out of Holmesville. That night we reached a Mr. McCrow's plantation, a distance of 10 or 15 miles, when we were ordered to halt. Large fires were built, and each one, spreading his blanket on the ground, laid down upon it. The white men lodged in the great house. An hour before day, we were aroused by the drivers coming among us, cracking their whips and ordering us to arise. Then the blankets were rolled up, and being severally delivered to me and deposited in the wagon, the procession set forth again. The following night it rained violently. We were all drenched, our clothes saturated with mud and water. Reaching an open shed, formerly a gin house, we found beneath it such shelter as it afforded. There was not room for all of us to lay down. There we remained huddled together through the night, continuing our march as usual in the morning. During the journey, we were fed twice a day, boiling our bacon and baking our corn cake at the fires in the same manner as in our huts. We passed through Lafayettesville, Mountsville, Newtown, to Centerville, where Bob and Uncle Abram were hired. Our number decreased as we advanced. Nearly every sugar plantation